Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's go. We've got an amazing show for you today. It is 2/2/22. February the 2nd, 2022. It's one to remember. Hard to forget. It's also Groundhog Day. We're going to be talking about the spiritual significance of the movie Groundhog Day. It's a classic, and it's got a lot of Catholic lessons for us, believe it or not. I know some of you are big fans. We're also going to talk about what I call the Compromised Billionaires Club. I'll tell you more about that later. And first of all, we're going to talk about a legendary relic. Today is the Feast of the Presentation of the Lord. It was also known as Candlemas for many, many years. I got to talk about a legendary relic involving this time period in our Lord's life from his infancy that has fueled a centuries-old quest. And it's something out of an adventure novel, and you're not going to believe this. I had not heard about this before. This was a new one on me. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a new one on you. But first, here are the digits to call. Digits is what I meant to say. 1-888-914-9149. Toll-free line to talk to me for free on the Cale Clark Show. It's our studio line here at Relevant Radio. 888-914-9149. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And my Twitter handle is at Cale Clark. Show account at Cale Clark Show. Clark with an E, of course. C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. Well, when you read the Gospel of Luke, just before Luke gives the account of the presentation, the verse right before that, it's Luke 2:21. Here's what it says. At the end of 8 days, when he was circumcised, he was called Jesus, the name given by the angel before he was conceived in the womb. And of course, 8 days after every Jewish male child was born, circumcision would be the norm. And so I want to tell you about a legendary relic from the Lord's circumcision, from this time, that has been really a subject of much fascination throughout the centuries, especially in the Middle Ages. There's a scholar named James White. And by the way, this Dr. James White is not the same James White, a Protestant scholar who has debated a lot of Catholics over the years about Scripture, including our very own Patrick Madrid. They've had lots of debates over the years. No, this man is much younger. He's a different James White, and he's also not the James White who played for the Patriots, but he is a scholar who did his PhD dissertation, his thesis. Every PhD student has to basically write a book before they graduate. And when he tells people about this topic that he wrote on, he's kind of an expert on. You kind of have to be this expert in this very narrow field that you're writing on. The first thing people do is they laugh, and the second thing they do after their laughing kind of subsides is ask him, really? This thing actually existed? This happened? So what was his topic? What is this book about? Well, Dr. James White, his PhD thesis is called Ring of Flesh. And believe it or not, it's all about the flesh of Jesus having to do with the day he was named, the day he was circumcised. And of course, every Jewish boy, as I said, was circumcised at 8 days of age. And somewhere in the Middle Ages, people developed this concept that the flesh of Jesus that was cut away might still exist. And kind of this devotion grew up around it. And in fact, this wasn't considered strange at all for about 1,000 years in the history of the church. And by the way, the whole concept of relics is very strange sometimes to people who are not members of the church, non-Catholics. Maybe you've come up against this in your life when you're trying to evangelize your friends, share the gospel with them. But secular people do this too. Secular people do this too. For example, if you're a film buff, you might know that Judy Garland, who of course was in The Wizard of Oz, the ruby slippers that she wore in that film, are now worth apparently $3 million U.S. I don't know if they're up for auction or not, but think about all the people who make quote-unquote pilgrimages to Graceland, to the tomb of Elvis Presley, the king, you know, the towels he would throw into the crowd, that sort of thing. Or think about the first edition of Action Comics from 1938, the first appearance of Superman in comic book form. That first appearance of Superman sold for $3.2 million back in 2014. So people do like to, even secular people sort of have the concept of relics, even though they're not quite there yet. And that might be seen as bizarre to other people. And when we think about relics, a lot of people do call us bizarre for thinking about them. Every Catholic altar in every parish in the world has a relic of at least one saint in the altar. That's the way it's supposed to be. And it could be a piece of bone from a saint, maybe a second-class relic, something that touched the saint or something like that, something that they owned. But this is... So I just wanted to just say that because people have some mental barriers to this, but they need not. They need not. And so there's some speculation, and this guy, Dr. James White, was interviewed by CBC a few months ago about this, and along with some other people on this topic. And one other guy that was interviewed was David Farley. I don't think he's any relation to Chris Farley or the late Catholic comedian. We talked about him on a prior show.
I live in a van down by the river.
Wow, that was quick, Lucas. And his brother Jim Farley is the CEO of Ford Motor Company. That's pretty incredible, too. Anyway, so this guy, David Farley, not the same guy. He's a travel writer. He was also interviewed on the program. He wrote a book called An Irreverent Curiosity, In Search of the Church's Strangest Relic and Italy's Oddest Town. So what this guy, David Farley, says was, quote, "It seems like maybe some clever relic collectors were looking through the Bible, and when they got to the Gospel of Luke, they read the part about Christ being circumcised on the eighth day of his life and had maybe a light bulb moment and thought, whoa, we could really make a heavenly prophet if we maybe told some monks or some priests that we have some of the flesh of Christ for sale." Now, is that really what happened? I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you. Apparently, there were, at one point during the Middle Ages, there were almost two dozen places around Europe, mostly in France, that claimed that they had the holy relic, the holy flesh of Christ. So, again, relics are very, very common in our Catholic tradition. Relics to do with our Lord, though, that's on a whole other level. That's on a whole other level. There are no relics, of course, of Our Lady, because she was assumed into heaven, body and soul, at the end of her earthly journey. We do have the saints. We have the incorruptibles, like Saint Bernadette of Lourdes. And if you've seen it, perhaps you've seen images of her incorrupt body. She is the most beautiful of all the incorrupts. So when it comes to Jesus, though, again, this was sort of the prize of all prizes. When it came, the Lord himself, we have a relic, we have some of his flesh, really? So allegedly, many churches claim to have this relic. At one point, the flesh of Christ allegedly arrived in Rome in the year 799 AD. King Charlemagne. Remember Charlemagne the Great? He presented it as a gift to Pope Leo III, and apparently it remained in the papal reliquary, that's where all the relics were kept, until Rome was sacked in the year 1527, and that was a really bad scene. Half the population of Rome died during that sack of Rome, and a lot of the sacred relics that the church had were either stolen or were destroyed. There's another incident, I don't know, I have not heard of this one before. It could be a legendary tale, could be apocryphal. The mystic marriage of Catherine of Siena. And you might have seen the very famous painting of this mystic marriage. Now, of course, those who are nuns are espoused to Jesus Christ, spiritually, as it were. He is the divine bridegroom. The church is the bride. They're obviously representing the church. You get the picture. Well, speaking of pictures, Giovanni di Paolo, in about the year 1460, painted this image of the mystic marriage of St. Catherine of Siena. And she had a vision in which she became spiritually espoused to Jesus Christ, and his flesh, this relic of his flesh, allegedly served as the wedding ring. Now, I had not heard of this before discovering this story. But here's where it gets into the modern day. So apparently one of the alleged, and again, there were many of them, almost two dozen, pieces of the holy flesh was said to have been discovered in the village of Calcutta, just north of Rome. Now, it's not Calcutta, India, or Kolkata. It's usually spelled with a K now. St. Mother Teresa of Kolkata. That's in India. It's a different place. So there's a village called Calcutta, C-A-L-C-A-T-A, just north of Rome. And they allegedly had the sacred flesh of Christ in their church. And it meant a lot to the people. And the Pope, apparently, at the time, ruled that, you know, this shall remain in this church for the rest of, until Christ returns. Now, that church is called the Church of the Holy Name, the Church of the Holy Name. Now, why is it called that? Because on the day that Jesus was circumcised, he was also officially named Jesus, which, of course, is the Hebrew Joshua or Yeshua, which means God saves. And of course, he really did do that, of course, in the person of Jesus. So the name was given to St. Joseph, of course, in a dream, according to Matthew's gospel, before this happened, but that's when he officially was given the name, 8 days after his birth. So every year on January the 1st, which is, of course, if you count from Christmas, December the 25th, that's 8 days after Christmas, the local priest in that church in Calcutta, in Rome, just north of Rome, the Church of the Holy Name would take out the relic and lead a procession around the village. Well, one person who didn't buy into this at all was Pope Leo XIII. Now, a prior Pope Leo, as I talked about just a couple minutes ago, Pope Leo III allegedly received the relic from King Charlemagne in 799 AD. Well, much, much later, in the year 1900, Pope Leo XIII, he issued a decree, and he basically said, hey, if anybody talks about this, if anybody even speaks about this alleged relic from Jesus or writes about it, I'm going to excommunicate you if anybody says anything about it. So obviously he didn't buy into it. He didn't buy into it at all. And some in the Vatican, including Pope Leo, thought that this was a superstition, didn't think it was legit at all. But strangely, for some reason, and nobody quite knows why that I can point my finger at, apparently somehow the Vatican allowed this village of Calcutta, this Church of the Holy Name, to keep doing this yearly procession on New Year's Day, 8 days after the birth of Jesus, until the year 1983. And this is where the story becomes a little bit like a Dan Brown novel. And believe me, The Da Vinci Code is terrible. I think it's terrible as a novel. It's historically inaccurate. I know some people are big fans of it. Not cool. Anyways, I mean, I could have said any number of different authors, but you get the picture. It's that kind of story. So in 1983, they were planning on doing this procession again at the Church of the Holy Name, just north of Rome. And a couple days before January the 1st, the Feast of the Holy Circumcision, the local priest went in to look for the relic and found that it was missing. It was gone. And nobody knows. Nobody knows what happened to it. Some people think that the priest himself actually gave it back to the Vatican. Others think that it was stolen by members of the occult. And as you know, when and this is a great tragedy, but in a sense, it's kind of evidence for the reality of the Eucharist, the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. The fact that in satanic mockeries of the Mass, there are people who go into Catholic parishes, pose as practicing Catholics, go up and receive our Lord. They will not consume the host, steal the host, and take it, and they will desecrate the host at these satanic masses. Now, you've heard about this, no doubt. it's kind of interesting that they always only want to use hosts from Catholic churches. I don't know whether they use Orthodox hosts consecrated in Orthodox churches either. They would be real Eucharist as well. But nonetheless, they know they're involved with the occult. They know the reality of the situation. Interestingly enough, many Catholics do not. When Jesus did his exorcisms in the gospel, you know, in Mark's gospel, Mark chapter 1, we know who you are, the Holy One of God. And Jesus says, shut up. I don't want acclamation from a demon. I don't want a demon to be my PR department, as it were. But this is mentioned also in the letter of St. James. So you believe that God is one. Great. Well, so do the demons, and they shudder. They know who Jesus is. Many others don't. But there is that theory that's out there as well, that's in operation, that this alleged relic, the flesh of Christ, allegedly was stolen by Satanists. Other people think that it was sold to someone and maybe a private collector of some sort. Nobody knows. The mystery was never solved. So that's one angle on this that you know we haven't gotten to the bottom of yet. But the point of this that I think is of interest is why people had this kind of devotion, whether or not the relic was real. Why would people be so interested in it anyways? And Miri Rubin, who is a professor of medieval early modern history in London at a school called Queen Mary University, she says really it was all about the incarnation. It was a period of time when people were thinking a lot about the incarnation, the humanity of Christ, the sacred humanity. And so when people thought about times like the presentation, when people thought about the naming of Christ, the circumcision of Christ, that kind of accents his humanity. And when you look at a lot of works of art that depict that scene in the life of our Lord, there's a lot of pathos, right? He's completely helpless. He's completely helpless. He is at the mercy of humanity, just as he is later on the cross. Also naked, and yes, he was crucified naked. These paintings that you see with a little towel around his waist, that's not how the Romans did it. They wanted maximum humiliation of the victim. And so this idea, the incarnation, he understands what it means to be human. And that's something I think that we've lost in modern times. We've lost a little bit of that focus on the humanity of Christ. I think if anything, we emphasize more his divinity and not necessarily enough of his humanity, but that's important as well. So I just thought, maybe you hadn't heard of this. I certainly had not heard of this. I don't know what to make of it necessarily, but it's a mystery. It's a detective story from the Middle Ages, this alleged relic from the Lord's circumcision, which of course occurs in Luke's gospel right before today's feast of the presentation. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Do you have a question or comment you want to take on this? Call in right now, 888-914-9149. I got to take a quick break right now, but we'll be right back. We're going to talk about the spiritual significance of Groundhog Day. You'd be surprised how much truth there is in this movie, which, of course, talks about the groundhog that came up today. And it's bad news for us, but we'll get into that later. We'll be right back on Relevant Radio.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the show. 888-914-9149. It's Feast of the Presentation of the Lord. We were talking about an alleged relic of Jesus that was floating around in the Middle Ages, allegedly, in a few different places. Is it true? I don't know, but it was something else. We're going to go to the phones right now. A lot of you guys have reactions to that. Dan calling from Milwaukee. Hello. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You got it.
So when I picked up the radio, I heard you say that we didn't have any relics of Mary, but I was thinking that maybe the house of at Loretto, and also I believe that there's a cloak of Joseph's that is held in the same location as a veil of Mary's someplace in Italy. I don't really know where, but I heard it on Relevant Radio a couple of weeks ago. Would those count as relics, don't they?
Well,
maybe they don't. I don't know.
I should probably clarify what I meant by that, Dan. What I meant was that no church in the history of Christendom has ever claimed to have, say, the bones of Our Lady or her physical remains. Obviously, you're talking about stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, so when I say, I guess I'd be referring to first-class relics there. But the Assumption of Mary, that's kind of, you know, a pretty good argument for it. It's an argument from silence in a lot of ways. But nobody, I mean, that would have been really the grand prize of relics in Christendom, to say, hey, our church was built over the, you know, the bones of Mary.
Yeah,
nobody
I
ever
agree.
Said that. Nobody ever claimed to have them. Now, in terms of possessions that she may have had, as you're indicating, there may be some traditions about that as to their authenticity. I can't say off the top of my head. The one that you mentioned I had not heard of before, the idea that there's a cloak of St. Joseph that he would have owned. And
with the veil of St. Mary. With the veil of Mary, too.
Okay, an alleged veil of Mary. Again, I can't comment on that. I don't know anything about that. Now, in terms of the Holy House of Loretto, that's another place I've never been. I haven't done much research into that. But I think the story, if I'm retelling it correctly, is that angels allegedly carried the home of the Holy Family to Loretto, where it now exists, and you can now see it. I don't know. I mean, one thing that last time I was in Nazareth, there's certainly a lot of places, by the way. There's certainly a lot of relics that I definitely think are real. And when you go to the Holy Land, you can see a lot of the actual places where Jesus walked, where Jesus taught. The synagogue at Magdala, we talked about that the other day. I've been there. That was uncovered, a first century synagogue. The original floor is there. You can also see the one in Capernaum where Jesus preached the Bread of Life discourse in John chapter 6. But when you go there now, that's a 4th century synagogue that was built on top of the one in the 1st century. And this is a tradition that the Jews had. St. Paul talks about this, building on top of someone else's work. And if there was a sacred place to the Jews, they wouldn't ever tear it down and build across the street or something like that where they could have a bigger parking lot for the synagogue. No, they would never do that. They would just build on top of the old sacred structure. And that's why when you go to Capernaum, if you go to the side of the synagogue, you can see the black basalt original foundation of the synagogue, and it was built on top of later on in Roman times. But there's a lot of volcanic rock in the area in Israel that they used for building projects. It's very plentiful. But anyways, in terms of the last time I was in Nazareth, I tried really hard to get into this place called the Church of the Nutrition. And there's a group of nuns there Yeah, this is a place I'm dying to get into. There's been some archaeological work done. They think that this is, in fact, the church or the place where the Holy Family lived when Jesus was an infant. And it's called the Church of the Nutrition, where obviously Mary would have fed Jesus, of course. And so this is a place where I'm dying to go. It's got some pretty good archaeological evidence, being first century. And so with respect to the Loretto house, I don't know, because I've never seen it. I don't know what kind of building materials the house was made of. In the first century, surprisingly, they didn't have tables, like made of wood and things like that. There's a scene in the Passion of the Christ movie. Sorry, go ahead, Dan.
The house in Loretto is made of stone that's been identified as a stone that is not native to Italy, but is native to the Nazareth or maybe Bethlehem area, mostly the Nazareth area. And the mortar also is identified as coming from Nazareth and could not have been made from the materials that they have in the Loretto area. I'm going to hang up, but I got two more second order relics for you for Jesus. There's the crown of thorns, which I believe is at the Notre Dame Cathedral in France. Mm-hmm. And the spear used to pierce his side while he was on the cross is in a church in Armenia.
Yeah, that's thanks for that, Dan. And I know you got to go. But I really do appreciate the call. And
yeah, great show. I love your show.
Oh, thank you, sir. I appreciate you very much, Dan. And call anytime. That was Dan calling from Milwaukee. We have a lot of listeners in the Milwaukee area, and I'm actually glad you said that, Dan, because I've done research on a lot of areas, a lot of holy sites in Israel. But in terms of Loretto, I've not been there, so I haven't seen it with my own eyes. I am pleased to hear, though, in terms of, I was just about to say, and Dan kind of took the words out of my mouth there. The fact that the structure is made of stone, I think that definitely, like if the house is made of wood, I don't think it's first century. I don't think it's from the time of Jesus, because they were made of stone at that point. And this Church of the Nutrition, it's kind of dug out of the rock kind of thing as well. Even the tables, I was going to say in the Passion of the Christ movie, there's kind of a nice scene about the relationship between Jesus and Mary. And remember that scene? They're kind of, if you haven't seen the film, they're Jesus is kind of working on a table, and he's kind of like just being very playful with Mary, splashing some water. They're splashing water on each other. They're joking around a little bit. It shows the humanity, really, and that the real relationship. I mean, some of my evangelical friends who think that, you know, Mary was just a vessel for Jesus to enter the world. No, she was his mother. They had a real relationship. I mean, come on. I thought that film really brought that out. But anyways, Jesus was building a wooden table, you know, his carpentry shop. That would never have happened. The tables were actually made of stone. And when you hear about people reclining at table, you know, in the Pharisee's house or even the Last Supper, it would have been like a table that's not too far off the ground, made of stone probably. And they're kind of lying down. They're kind of reclining on their elbow because you have to get low to eat at this table. And you're kind of just chilling out. And if you got a good spot at the table, then you're kind of laying out there. And if you got a bad spot, you're at somebody's sandals, I guess, and, you know, you're on the other end. But anyways, that's the lower part of, you know, the bad seats at the dinner. But you're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Okay, let's go back to the phones right now. Let's go to Tracy in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Hello, Tracy.
Hello, Cale. How are you?
I'm well. Yourself?
Oh, great. I love your show. And
thank you.
I didn't know about the Jesus relic on the flesh. And what struck me is, being a Catholic, 12 years of Catholic mm-hmm. school, including kindergarten, mm-hmm. Jesus suffered, died, and was buried. And on the third day, he rose to heaven.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But wouldn't all his flesh go with him?
Well, this would have been stemming from his circumcision as an infant on the eighth day, as all Jewish male children were circumcised. So that flesh would not have been part of his resurrection body. Now, of course, where did it go is the question. And there was this tradition in the Middle Ages that it became a relic and was, you know, many churches claimed to have it or part of it. And it's a fascinating part of church history that I wasn't very aware of. But this guy, James White, Dr. James White, did his PhD study on it. That would be an interesting book to read. I don't know if it's been published.
I think you're right. I think I'm going to have to delve into that a little bit just for my own curiosity, because just as a human, I find it hard to believe that would have been kept at that time.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a thing with a lot of alleged relics. And there's an old saying, I don't know if you've heard this one, but some people say, for example, the True Cross, a lot of people claim to have bits and pieces, splinters of the True Cross. How legitimate are them? I think you'd have to look at them on a case-by-case basis, but there's really no way to prove it, right? There's the story of St. Mm-hmm. Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine. After his conversion, she went to the Holy Land. She did a tour there and allegedly brought back pieces from the True Cross back home. And some people say there are enough relics of the True Cross out there to rebuild Noah's Ark. In other words, they don't think that they're legitimate. I mean, at one level, Tracy, I would say this. I like when we go to Mass, we receive the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ. We actually come into contact with Christ himself. Now, obviously, sacramentally, not in a fleshly manner. But when we have, say, Eucharistic miracles, like Lanciano, Italy, where the host does turn to flesh, the appearance of bread is kind of, the veil is taken away to reveal what's really there. And the Vatican had it looked at by secular scientists, and they discovered that it was a human heart, the flesh from a human heart, right, expertly dissected, the literal heart of Christ, as it were. The blood type was AB. They even knew the blood type. Now, a lot of preachers will say it was type O, the universal donor. Get it? You know, but great preaching, but it's not actually true. It was a blood type AB. But the point is, it had all the properties of living flesh. So sometimes when I hear about relics, sometimes I think, well, wow, they're good. Saints can inspire us, and their lives can inspire us for sure. But I remember once being at Mass, and this is kind of a sidebar story, but I remember the priest saying, hey, I've got some holy cards to hand out after the Mass. If anybody wants them, I'll just kind of stand here and you can come up and get them. There was a stampede for these holy cards. Like, they were running and tripping over each other to get these holy cards he was handing out. But when it came to the Eucharist, people didn't seem that excited about it. Now, maybe they really were internally, I don't know, but Christ is, this is the ultimate, right? We can sometimes even forget about how incredible the Eucharist is because we're so focused on other stuff. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's human psychology at some level, but is that making any sense, Tracy? I don't know, just a stray thought
no,
that I had
does.
About this.
It does, but on a second note, I do actually have two relics of St. John Newman, who,
okay.
From Philadelphia, mm-hmm. from St. Peter's Church, back in 1980, when my mother became gravely ill and died in 5 months. I went down there, being a Philly girl, and they were kind enough to give me two relics. I have a little piece of his cloth and a little bone that is encrypted in glass.
Mm.
And we prayed on that and for my mother, and I still have them.
Wow, an American
so
saint.
So they do have a lot of power in them.
Yeah, well, hey, an American saint, right? St. John Neumann, right? So.
Yep, St. John Neumann, founder of the Catholic schools, and he's done a lot of good in our world.
Absolutely, and hopefully you're a living American saint as well, Tracy. Hopefully we're all living saints. You know,
I'm
you got to be a saint.
Progress, but that's my end result.
Yeah, we're all work in progress, but that's the goal, right? To be canonizable saints. Hey, Tracy, appreciate you. Thank you very, very much for the call. That was a great call. And got another call coming in from Therese, who's in Monrovia, California. Hello, Therese.
Hi, Kale. Can you hear me?
I sure can. You're on the air. I can hear you loud and clear.
Okay. My question is, St. Joseph was a mm-hmm. carpenter, which to me means working with wood.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned that all the tables and stuff were stone. So I'm
yeah.
just wondering if St. Joseph was constantly out of work or what?
Yeah, well, that's a good question because the word that's translated as carpenter, and sort of in the romantic imagination, we do think of woodworking. And I've even heard some preachers say, this did not happen. I guarantee you this did not happen. I've heard some people even say that, hey, in Joseph's carpentry shop, one day Jesus actually was, he made the wood for what would be his own cross one day. No, that didn't happen. But so we think about woodworking, we think about that sort of stuff, modern day carpentry, as it were. But what does that word actually mean? Well, in the New Testament, the word that's translated as carpenter is actually the Greek word tekton. It's an interesting word, and it refers to somebody who is more than just a carpenter. And we know Jesus was far more than a carpenter, but this could be somebody who is proficient in all kinds of construction, working with stone, working with various materials. And in fact, there's a city which is just a really short walk where from Jesus grew up in Nazareth. It's called Sepphoris. I don't know if you've ever heard of this, but it was very common years ago for people to say that Jesus was from a backwater town. He lived in the sticks, as it were. That's what we used to say. People lived in the country growing up. They lived out in the sticks. And he was kind of a part of a hillbilly culture. They weren't, you know, into the Greco-Roman intellectual scene or anything like that. Well, that's been proven by archaeology to be not tenable because right off the off-ramp, there is a major Roman road in a big city called Sepphoris. And Josephus, the great Jewish historian, called it the jewel of the region. It was just a magnificent city. And at one point, the emperor was going to make his home there. He changed his mind, but it was a city of Greco-Roman architecture. There's a beautiful theater in Sepphoris. And you can still go there today. There was major, major work going on there when Jesus was growing up, when Joseph was still alive. And some people speculate that maybe Jesus and Joseph went there for work because plenty of work would have been out there to be had, just a short walk from Nazareth. So Jesus might have been exposed to all kinds of different things. And some people think this theater at Sepphoris is where he got the whole idea of the hypocrites from. Because the word, you know, we know it is a bad term when you call somebody a hypocrite. That's not exactly a compliment in this day and age. But the word hypocrite was pretty innocuous in Jesus' day. It only meant an actor, a play actor. It's possible Jesus and Joseph were maybe working on construction of this theater. Maybe they saw the odd play or two, or maybe saw people walking around. This idea of putting on a mask. Jesus says, don't do it. When it comes to your personal piety, don't put on a mask. Don't fake it, because God knows the truth. And so it really comes out in his preaching. But so this word tekton, some people suggest that it might even refer to kind of like a modern day engineer. You could construct things, you could plan things, you were proficient with all kinds of materials. So this was quite a profession. It's not just mere carpentry working with wood. That might have been part of it, but I think there's much more to it than that. So hopefully that sheds a little bit of light on this for you, Therese.
Yes, thank you.
You're most welcome. You're most welcome. Call back anytime. That was Therese calling from Monrovia, California. Got to take a quick break right now. We haven't got to Groundhog Day, but I promise that'll pop up right after the break. 888-914-9149. You won't want to miss this. Please stay tuned.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. Call 888-914-9149. Sounds like you're calling for a tow truck or something. You know, when you're stuck, call. No, but hey, if you're stuck, if you have a question about the faith, you can call me right now. 888-914-9149. If you want to react to anything you've heard so far on the show. Hey, I got to talk to you about something else. Probably something you've never thought about before. The spiritual significance of Groundhog Day, not the actual Groundhog Day, which is also today, February the 2nd, but the movie starring Bill Murray. Just to let you know, in case you hadn't heard, the actual groundhog, and there are many groundhogs who play the role during this day all around the world, but the one that most people know about is called Punxsutawney Phil from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and apparently he came up out of his groundhog hole today, and he did see his shadow, which means, I can never remember this, but I think it means six more weeks of winter, right, Lucas?
That is correct.
That is correct. All right. Well, okay, let's get to the Bill Murray Groundhog Day. And by the way, we're probably going to see a lot of Bill Murray this weekend at the Pebble Beach Pro-Am golf tournament. If you're a fan of the PGA Tour, it's always a fun tournament, a beautiful golf course, one of the most beautiful in the world, Pebble Beach. Bill Murray always plays in this. He's always joking around with the fans. He's kind of reenacting his character from Caddyshack, probably, in a lot of ways. But one of his most famous roles, and really this kind of cemented his legacy in a lot of ways, was the 1993 film Groundhog Day, which was directed by Harold Ramis, also a comedian, who also, as you might know, starred alongside Bill Murray in the movie Ghostbusters. Well, in 1993, he directed Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, and it's a day, it's about a guy who just lives the same day over and over and over again, almost like on an endless loop. And by the way, today over on Word on Fire on their website, a great friend of the program, Andrew Pettiprin, who is a former Episcopalian priest, who's now converted to Catholicism. He's been on the show before. He's a friend of the program. Very, very interesting guy. He writes a lot about faith and culture, movies, films, all kinds of media. Great dude. He's got a really, really good article. We'll post it in the show notes about Groundhog Day and the spiritual significance of the movie. A lot of people have written about this. I know a guy who shows it every year to a bunch of Catholic college students. He runs he's the director of a Catholic residence at a university, and he makes sure that they all watch Groundhog Day the first semester, and he goes into this huge talk about the spiritual significance of it. Anyway, so Andrew Pettiprin writes about this, and he says that it's the most iconic role that Bill Murray ever played, and he actually has a little interesting historical tidbit for those of you. It's kind of like a Wikipedia bit of trivia here. Apparently, Tom Hanks was offered the role, turned it down. And so did Michael Keaton. And Michael Keaton, of course, as you might know, played Batman. He was the first Batman on film in modern times, of course, with Jack Nicholson as the Joker in the Tim Burton film. He also played Beetlejuice. He played, I think he was Mr. Mom, if you remember that movie. And more recently, he played a supervillain, the Vulture, in the Spider-Man film. I always get these mixed up because every one of them has home in the title, you know, the new trilogy of Spider-Man films starring Tom Holland as Peter Parker / Spider-Man. Well, the first one was called Spider-Man Homecoming, and the second was called No Way Home, Spider-Man No Way Home. Now, the one that is out now was called Far From Home. No, Far From Home was the second one, and then No Way Home is the last one, right?
That's right.
That's right, Producer Lucas. And there's no way I'll ever remember that, get that straight. But anyway, so in the first one, Michael Keaton played the Vulture. He's kind of an older guy, becomes a supervillain. And he used to crack up Tom Holland when they were filming the fight scenes. Tom Holland was Spider-Man and Michael Keaton was the Vulture. And he, every time they'd like kind of get close and they're grappling and they're fighting, Michael Keaton would whisper in his ear, "I'm Batman." And anyways, Tom Holland would just crack up. He couldn't continue the scene. But that's a strange rabbit trail there. But let's get back on. Forget about rabbits. Let's get back to the groundhogs. Groundhog Day. So Bill Murray, apparently, according to Andrew Pettiprin, he took the role on Groundhog Day just as his own, unfortunately, his real-life marriage was falling apart. And things were really, really tense on set between Bill Murray and the director Harold Ramis, because Ramis kind of wanted it to be like a rom-com, very light, very funny, please the crowd. But Bill Murray wanted it to be kind of dark. He wanted it to be like sort of a dark, introspective exploration of the character that, that Bill Murray was playing. And anyways, I think they wound up, as Pettiprin says, they kind of wound up hitting on both cylinders there. It is a sort of a deep philosophical explanation of certain themes, and it's a spiritually great film. But it's also one of the best comedies ever made, too. So it's got rare balance there. And where did this really come from? Where did the inspiration come from? Well, the writer of the film, his name is Danny Rubin. You should have changed his name to Billy Rubin, anyways. One of my brothers-in-law, he had a sort of an imaginary band that he wanted to start called Billy Rubin and the Spleen Machines. Anyways, so Danny Rubin wrote the script for Groundhog Day. And apparently he was, at the time, he was reading the works of Anne Rice, you know, the vampire stuff. He was reading the vampire Lestat, you know, which was later played by Tom Cruise, of course, in a film. Anne Rice had an interesting Catholic journey, left the church, came back, left again. She recently passed away. We talked about that on the program. This idea of living forever like a vampire, you never die. Well, that's kind of what happens to Bill Murray's character on Groundhog Day. He just keeps reliving the same day again and again and again. So Danny Rubin, when he was writing it, he was thinking about that. And people have always sort of had this conception of what if existence is really cyclical, right? Phil Connors, this character that Bill Murray plays in Groundhog Day, he doesn't realize that he is actually called to become holy, to become a saint. But eventually, through living the same day, Groundhog Day, over and over and over again, he kind of figures it out. So here's a clip from the film when he's in Punxsutawney, and he kind of wakes up on this first of his many, many Groundhog Days, and this is what happens.
Then put your little hand in mine. There ain't no hill or mountain we can't climb, babe. I got you, babe. I got you, babe.
Okay, campers, rise and shine. And don't forget your booties, because it's cold out there.
Today. It's cold out there every day. What is this, Miami Beach?
Hardly. And, you know, you can expect hazardous travel later today with that, you know, that blizzard thing.
Oh, that blizzard thing.
Mm-hmm. Been there. In case you've never seen the film, the character played by Bill Murray, Phil, he's a Pittsburgh weatherman. And apparently he treats his coworkers terribly. He treats everybody that works for him or with him at the TV station just like as a lower class, as an inferior type of person. And I hope I don't do that to you, Producer Lucas. I hope I treat you like an equal in this profession, because you certainly are. No comment from
no
Lucas.
Comment.
Okay,
I'm just kidding.
Speaks volumes. But anyway, so Phil, the weatherman, he thinks he's heading to bigger and better things in life, but he's also alone. He's living kind of a solitary life. And when he wakes up in his cozy bed and breakfast in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, he wants to report on the shadow of the groundhog. But he wakes up and he hears the Sonny and Cher song, "I Got You, Babe." And you just heard that as well in the clip. Sidebar, my wife keeps having a nightmare that one day I'm going to run off and leave her and marry Cher. I don't know where this comes from. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. So don't worry. I got you, babe. Just you. So anyway, so he runs into an old schoolmate And this happens the same morning, happens to him every single day. But he's smitten with this woman named Rita, who is played by Andie MacDowell. Anyways, he keeps doing the same day over and over again. He half-heartedly broadcasts the groundhog ceremony. It snows so much he can't go back to the city of Pittsburgh, so he stays there at the bed and breakfast, falls asleep, and he keeps waking up to the same day, February 2nd, again and again and again and again and again. And somebody has figured out that he did this 12,395 times, 33 years and 350 days. And Andrew Petiprin says, well, maybe that is more than a coincidence when you think about the age of Christ, 33 years, the crucifixion, the resurrection at that time. I don't know. So he starts living the same day over and over again, and he says, well, if there's never a tomorrow, if every day is the same, then I'm just going to do whatever I want. I'm going to throw the moral law out the window, do whatever I feel like doing. He starts indulging in self-destructive behavior, stuffs his face with cake, goes for a joyride on a railroad track, and he lives out all of his Western movie fantasies, and he dresses up like Bronco Billy. It's very funny. But it's also very dark, as Bill Murray wanted it to be. But eventually he gets tired of his sin. And if you live long enough in sin, eventually you get tired of it. So he tries to woo this woman, Rita. And here's a clip. And he eventually gets to this point where he thinks he's like a living God. And he can do whatever he wants. This is what happens, the conversation between Rita and Phil.
I'm a God.
You're a God.
I'm a God. I'm not the God, I don't think.
Because you survived a car wreck?
You folks ready to order?
I didn't just survive a wreck. I wasn't just blown up yesterday. I have been stabbed, shot, poisoned, frozen, hung, electrocuted, and burned.
Oh, really?
And every morning I wake up without a scratch on me, not a dent in the fender. I am an immortal.
Special today is blueberry waffles.
Why are you telling me this?
Because I want you to believe in me.
You're not a god. You can take my word for it. This is 12 years of Catholic school talking.
I could come back if you're not ready.
How do you know I'm not a god?
Oh, please.
How do you know?
Because it's not possible.
I'll come back.
All right, okay, so that's a famous scene from the movie. You're not a god. You can take my word for it. This is 12 years of Catholic school talking. Well, usually when people say that, they go on to say something that's totally not Catholic, But she's right. She's right in this case. And he's got a very big holiness deficit. And she kind of challenges him to get better. And so he discovers a few things in the film. He can't save an old homeless man from dying. No matter how many ways this tries to happen, every day is the same. He can't do it. He's not all-powerful. He's not omniscient. He can't pull it off. But he can save some people. He saves a boy who falls out of a tree, saves a man who chokes in a restaurant. And he figures out that he can make other people's lives better. And the thing is, like, since every day is the same, nobody remembers the good deeds that he did the day before. So it's kind of starting fresh all over again. So he finds joy, as Petiprin writes about, in doing these good deeds for their own sake. They're truly selfless acts because he never gets any credit for them. People always forget that the next day is a new day, but it's the same day. And he gets better. He gets better. He becomes more the best version of himself, which is what we're all called to be. So Petiprin has some interesting thoughts in his article about how this kind of applies to our lives. It's not a movie about reincarnation because he's always himself. He doesn't come back as somebody else the next day. It's always him. And in our lives too, every day, sometimes every day seems like they all kind of stretch and seem like they're the same day over and over again, especially during the pandemic when we were in lockdown. So we've got to really work in the midst of our monotony, as Petiprin says, to really understand that, you know, eternity is kind of breaking in here and we have a chance to choose. So anyways, I thought it was an interesting piece. We'll link to it. The Bill Murray character eventually figures out that his will is not the answer. He's got to conform his will to a greater power for the benefit of others. He's got to choose the good. So anyways, that's something I found interesting. Heaven and hell, in a certain sense, begin in time in this seemingly monotonous life. And we've got to choose every single day. Jesus says, hey, eternal life is knowing you, the one true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you've sent. Starts now. Separation from God starts in this life too and just kind of continues on out into the next. C.S. Lewis said, the door to hell is locked from the inside. And so the character of Phil, Groundhog Day, makes the choice to open the door to the divine. There's so many probably theses that could be written about this film. And Adrienne, sorry we couldn't take your call. Adrienne from Austin, Texas is on the line. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but she wanted to tell me that Bill Murray's sister is a religious nun. I had heard that. I had heard that, Adrienne. So thank you very much for calling in. Call back next time because we have run out of time. As always, I wish I had more time. I wish it was kind of Groundhog Day on the show and I could just, you know, hour after hour, but you get tired of that. So I'll give you a break, but I'll be back tomorrow. Same time, same channel here on Relevant Radio. You can always catch the podcast later. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alog took your calls. Thanks for joining me today on this great feast day of the presentation. So I hope you're able to celebrate with your loved ones, with your friends. Have a good meal. And thank God for all the great things he's doing in our lives. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.